This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
The dynamics and politics of code reuse.
Okay. Wait, let me make sure. Okay, yeah, got it. So I don't believe we have any follow-up this week.
Actually, I didn't even check. So we are recording a new night, so I'm a little bit a little out of sorts.
Right, but I don't believe we have any follow-up. Mm-hmm. So away you go.
Okay. So with code reuse, I would say that there are two facets into the issue of code reuse, and at least two facets. I would say it has to do with complexity and control. So let's start with the idea of what happens when you decide to put a fragment of code in its own method. And for a lot of this, I was thinking subroutines, but then I realized, man, I haven't written a procedural chunk of code in a really long time. Like, it's pretty much it's all in methods nowadays. So I'll just say, I might slip up, and maybe I haven't updated my notes everywhere. I might call it subroutine here, but we'll just assume a method. So a lot of times when you put code into method, it's kind of like something that's kind of imposed by the framework for you. Like, when you have to supply the number of rows in a table view or something like that, you know, you pretty much have to have a method there. It has to be given as a name, and you know, you can't do anything else. So that pretty much fills that out for you. But the rest of it is kind of how you decide how to structure your software internally. And with often as you're writing the code is, well, so then you have to decide like when do I create a new method for something? And so I tend to create new methods when I find I have a common chunk of functionality that I want other methods to take advantage of, or if I want to supply an interface to other classes. But I want to concentrate on the first, because that's kind of more the code reuse thing I want to address right now.
Sure, more the extract.
Yes, you're right. Exactly, in the refactoring terms. And Andrew, I know that you and I are pretty much on the same side here. When we see that we need to duplicate code, that's when we say, okay, we need to put it in its own method. And right there, you have a bunch of problems because software isn't easy, is it?
What? No, it's totally easy.
Oh, okay. We can just end this podcast then.
Right, we're done.
Number one, especially in Objective-C, you now have a new method name out there, hanging out there. And even if you don't put it in your .h file, it's still a symbol that could be invoked. And it could be in conflict with Apple's classes. It could conflict with subclasses. It's kind of out there. I actually like the old pattern I used to use in old school Objective-C is that I would have a category, and I would name that on the same class in my .m file. I would name that private, and kind of put like all these basically these like implementation methods that I don't really want anyone else to touch except my own class. Now in the modern Objective-C I'm using, I guess they call them class extensions, where it looks like categories, but you don't put any name on that.
Right.
Yeah. So then,
yeah, that's basically it's as good as declaring it in your class. Mm-hmm. For a couple of reasons. I think the compiler likes it a little better for that regard.
Yeah, there was always like some like before Clang, I know that methods had to be in order to see each other and stuff like that, and yeah, because otherwise you'd have to declare your private category at the top of your .m file, and then you could then provide the implementation details in the bottom.
But in any case, it's not like you can't do it the way you used to do. Right. It's just the habits have changed a bit is all. Mm-hmm.
And so I almost wish that there was a way to have these. I wish there was like first class language support or to declare methods as being implementation methods and not so much private methods. It's like almost like beyond what we do have private in Objective-C, but of course you can just
file put it on methods, right?
right.
I think other languages basically have this idea of declaring something private because there are no headers. Mm-hmm. So that's what they do. They let you say, no, you can only use this method inside of your class. And it's enforced by the language in a way that you can't get around like you can in Objective-C.
Right. And like with the Java and JVM, they actually, and that's like pretty enforced in terms of a real security type thing, where you can't actually invoke methods, even if they're there. The JVM makes sure that doesn't happen. I'm hoping, so far Swift doesn't have any sort of access controls, and I believe it's been promised. And yes. I'm thinking it probably won't be as hardcore as Java, because remember, this Java system was developed in the idea of applets and insecure code and stuff like that. Apple seems to be using XPC and the like for kind of the idea of running secure code and putting up barriers and stuff like that. So they don't seem to be doing it at the class level.
Well, I would be disappointed if they didn't actually enforce it at runtime, just because that would be yet another darn thing to have to deal with in terms of writing your own interfaces for your classes.
Oh, really? I suspect they'll probably yell at you at compile time. It'd be interesting to see what they do at runtime. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point.
And so, it's not so bad when you have, you've identified this, you're about to copy and paste code. You're like, no, I'm a good programmer. I'm going to put this in its own method. And right there, we're already having kind of issues where we can't really just have an implementation method. You could put in maybe a static function, C function, and call it that way. That actually probably is
right.
Mm-hmm. Pretty well.
I've done that. I've done that quite a bit.
I've actually never done that. That's interesting. Maybe I should be doing that more.
Right, because you said you were never writing functions anymore. And I was like, well, I write functions, a decent amount.
Good point.
I do it more in order to isolate the logic from any other properties or state in the class. If I want to be sure this helper method doesn't have any backdoor access to anything else, that's really more often when I put it in the function. But I also sometimes do it just to make sure no one else can get to it, because then nobody else can go to it, because it's not even, the symbol isn't even visible.
Right.
Yeah.
And so once you've extracted this code and put in its own method, and you're doing it just because you don't want to duplicate code, now this you have this this new method that has at least two dependencies, and so when time comes to change something, and let's say you need to change the implementation detail in this extracted method, now you have to kind of think of the ramifications and how it's going to affect at least two clients. And of course, if this method is exposed in your .h file as a honest to goodness interface, and then you might not even be aware of what clients you have, and you just kind of have to go along with the contract that you've laid out in your method signature to hopefully that your changes you want to make won't break your clients. And so software evolution is really hard, and we're just banging rocks here together, that it's all we have to do, the only tool we have is names, symbols, and it's really hard to evolve software with it. I mean, the closest thing we really have is that we invent new names that weren't in previous systems, and then we can deprecate existing names, saying, oh, these will go away soon, and get warnings that way. But, man, this is really primitive. About the fanciest thing I could see in terms of, at least on the Mac, I don't know how much this is done on iOS, but on OS X, it will. There's all sorts of hacks in AppKit and such that will look for when a program is running. It will look at what version of AppKit the process has linked to, and will make decisions at runtime what type of behavior these functions should these methods should have, based on what is expected by the implicit contract of AppKit in that version, which is amazing that it works at all, but it's quite primitive. And so you have this basic concept of like just extracting methods just so it can be reused in more than one place. And already you have kind of like you have this in your little microcosm. You have these dependency issues of having to keep track. When it's just in your own class, and if you're maybe in a more static language than Objective-C, it's a lot more feasible to kind of track down everything that's changed and so forth. But immediately you can kind of start to see the complexities of what happens when you try to, instead of like putting everything in line and you try to reuse this code, it's not a slam dunk. It comes with a cost, and that cost is complexity. But part of the issue is, I did mention the symbols that all we have is names, and this is one of the reasons why I'm a big proponent of the semantic versioning concept I believe I mentioned previous episodes, but...
Yes, you have. I remember. One of the early ones. I can't find it right away.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll put a link to it in the show notes again. And I almost wish that this is, kind of goes back to kind of the contracts thing, but it is kind of an orthogonal issue that with if we could somehow better version our APIs, then we could allow better dependency analysis at compile time than what we have today. If you could say this is basically version 1.0 of a function that I've extracted. And I know I have these two internal implementation dependent methods that are using it, and then I go and change it in an incompatible way. That would be much more feasible for the compiler to track down to see how it's used. Xcode already has some functionality along these terms where it can now list callers of a method, which is actually pretty impressive, that can do static analysis to figure out what's called. Again, with Objective-C's very dynamic runtime support, it's there can be holes in that support. And whenever you can do selector from string type stuff and fire off random messages to random instances, of course, that's hard for the compiler to figure out, and I guess it's basically impossible. But... there's already a pretty huge cost in terms of just kind of reusing code just in your own little microcosm of your own class, and it gets worse as you spiral out and you involve other classes that are using your interface. And I try to minimize the number of methods I create. I know I've talked to you before about the double curly technique in terms of putting code in line. So the idea is that you can kind of put code in its own scope and put it all in line, and hopefully it helps separate out the code without having to have the overhead of putting it into a static method, a static function like you do. There is another school of thought, which is from the I've seen it pretty much attributed to Bob Martin, and he wrote this book called Clean Code, and I think this is where it comes from, but I'm not 100% sure. I did crack the book open and look for it, and the chapter Function on Functions kind of references it, but it might be from another book of his. But anyway, the idea of creating a bunch of new method names and kind of dividing things up, not as a way to reuse code, but just to improve code readability.
Just to organize it.
Yes,
yeah.
Just for organization.
I know some people who are really into that and really dislike my way of doing it, such that you need to have two clients before you put anything into a method. Some people are really opposed to that.
Yeah. And, you know,
because they don't like, I think it's because they don't like, the rule of thumb is that you don't want a method that's too long. Right. That's really what they're trying to optimize against.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think, I do think it's one of these things where there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. Like, I could totally see that way of thinking. And I have been on the receiving end of code that has a lot of methods and it is kind of self-describing, and you do read software more than you write it. So I definitely see their point of view. For me, it's the concerns are entangled to each other, that when you put code into a method, it's not just so you can reuse it across other methods, but it also exposes it, and that's another way software can break. So it would be nice if you could somehow detangle them, where you could use methods in an organizational way without exposing them, which is, I guess, again, I'm asking for the implementation keyword or something that would allow methods to be basically super private, basically could be rewritten to be static functions, essentially.
Well, and even if you have, even with that, the problem is that you've now made a disjoint narrative, to coin a phrase, in that you now have to keep going to other places just to follow what's going on through this one code thread. Mm-hmm. And that can be annoying to do, especially if it's really complicated code that tends to, you know, do a lot of little steps, and suddenly just to figure out how to, you know, do something extremely simple, like, you know, add a blog post or something, you've got to go to three different files and 10 different places, and then go back to where you were before, and then go back to somewhere else. It can be annoying to run through that.
Yeah, definitely. Following the optic graph of the code is something that computers really excel at, and human beings tend to kind of more suffer at it. But again, it's one of these trade-off things that if you don't really care about implementation details, you can see why a higher level description of what a function does can would be preferable to just having splat what it actually does right in front of you when you don't really care. So it's, you have to walk the line between what the level where you think is like where you think the trade-offs are in terms of human understanding versus implementation efficiency. Although I'm really less concerned about implementation efficiency nowadays, especially again, this is something that's less tractable in Objective-C, but Swift it should be pretty able to do things like inline code and stuff like that. So it's really a matter of taste, and I don't think there's really a wrong answer there. But I think that
I do, but I'll get to that.
Okay, I'm glad you're building up your list of hate. So that was just kind of just a quick run through about the complexity of when you reuse code internally. Of course, there's a bunch of complexity that's involved when you reuse code that you yourself didn't write. So it's code that other people write. And so the type of, I've identified, I think, four possibilities about where code can come from. It can come from the language vendor, it can come from your tool vendor, it can come from the platform vendor, or it can come from the glorious internet. And the problem, and every code authorship scenario has problems. Of course, we'll start with our case that we start with, which is when you yourself write your own code. Of course, if you have your own code and you keep it private to yourself, that means you had to write it and now you have to maintain it. All the costs involved are on you. At least that's a known issue. It's probably a known cost. You don't have to worry about the outside world too much. And so you kind of take your lumps up front of having to write it and then keep it working from there. So not too many boogeymen are going to come in and do bad things to your code base then if it's totally under control and you keep it private. You could also take the code you've written and maybe decide, well, I wrote this code, but maybe I can kind of use the glorious internet to help support it, help maintain it. And so this opens up a bunch of issues. First off, if you're like most at least Apple developers, is that your entire app isn't open source, and so you're going to have to decide on the dividing lines in your application between what you're willing to make public and what you aren't. There's also some intellectual property exposure issues that you have to worry about. You have to pick a side in license wars. Are you going to go with GPL or are you going to go with MIT or BSD style or what have you? And then there's the support burden where you have to put this thing up, probably have to write at least a little bit of documentation. GitHub in particular will nag you if you don't at least put a README up there. And then you have issue tracker and people are going to ask you questions and hopefully at the end of the day you get more pull requests and stuff like that will kind of offset all this work you had to do up front, and that'll give you a good return on investment of you releasing to the public. Or you could do, which is kind of a hybrid approach, hybrid is probably a bit too kind because it's just more of a shirking of responsibility, that you can do you can release your code publicly but kind of do a kind of throw it over the wall type thing where you don't really maybe go out of your way to document too much, and maybe you're not giving it support at all, but maybe you'll accept some pull requests. Downside to that is of course, you probably feel kind of crummy about yourself. You're not being a good open source citizen. As an author of a surprising number of GitHub repositories out there, the kind of throwing it over the wall option is, I think it's a pretty good option. It sounds kind of crummy, but on one hand, I get to put a lot of code out there that I know helps people. And if I spent all my time trying to be a good open source citizen for all the source code I ship, I couldn't write any more code. It'd be a full time job for me just to support what's out there. And so the shirking of responsibility is, I kind of think it's maybe perhaps a necessary evil. And so that's the scenario for when you've written the code. So the next one I thought of was language vendors. So if you look at languages like C and C++, those guys have like specifications that kind of tell you what the standard library will be, but they don't actually provide implementations of those. Those are up to the tool vendors to supply those. But then right. you have other languages like Python and Ruby that have standard libraries, and they supply implementations of those. So it's all over the map. And Objective-C is really interesting in terms of, I don't know if it's a standard or not. It doesn't really matter if it.
Oh, it's totally not a standard.
Okay, it's totally not a standard.
I mean, it's .NET. You know, it's C Sharp. It's Java. I mean, I guess Java is sort of a standard. But
well, you know, even C Sharp is ECMA. ECMA something.
Yeah.
Yes. It's good we both laughed at that. But that said, you know, Objective-C did, at least for a long time, try to take itself seriously, where it did not, where it's like, okay, this is the language, and yes, there's this thing called foundation, but we don't require it. And you could write your own foundation if you want, and stuff like that. So they tried to do the right thing. It was only with the start of, like Athro knowing about NS exception specifically type stuff that the walls started coming down.
And now, we've talked about this before. This was back when Apple needed help.
Yeah.
And now they don't need help, and now they don't. Mm-hmm. They're not as eager to vend. They're not as eager to support third parties as they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the if your language vendor is supplying code for you to write, code for you to use. This is, again, it comes back to the primitive nature of all we have is symbols, is that standard libraries tend to kind of grow and grow and grow, and the old stuff tends to never be able to be thrown away. Deprecation that's common on iOS and across different SDKs tends to not happen in language libraries. Usually how they deprecate things is that they just declare a totally new language version, and then they can declare right. that incompatible. But the libraries themselves tend to be, you know, kind of by the nature of the beast, is that they're tied really tightly with the language. The good thing about standard libraries is that it's basically part and parcel of the language, that you can, if someone says they're fluent in Python, then they're essentially saying that I also know how to use a good chunk of the standard library. On the good side, you know, it's it helps with kind of people understanding the libraries. On the bad side, these tend to be kind of stagnant, and they don't change very quickly, and they don't tend to get rid of stuff that they probably should. So they don't move nearly as fast as, say, Apple with its SDK. And it's, I forget how many new APIs they said they announced with iOS 8, but it was a lot. And Apple's also deprecated a bunch of stuff through the years. So it'd actually be interesting to know if Apple, especially with the wholesale killing off of Carbon, like if they've actually have deprecated more and killed off more symbols than they have ever written new symbols. I mean, obviously not written, but like versus how many symbols are out there today. I'll leave that as an exercise for the listeners.
For somebody who has more time to do that than we do.
So the tool vendor, I said that with languages like C and C++, we have this idea that you have the guys who specify the language, and then you have the guys who implement the language, and never the twain shall meet type stuff. And this is kind of arthritic, and... So when the tool vendors give you libraries, the good thing is that they tend to be pretty high quality. Maybe I've just been colored by my pretty good experiences in terms of the Mac tool providers. Especially MetaWorks is pretty good with their standard libraries. I think HPUX and the like had pretty crappy standard libraries implementations. So again, that's kind of not only is the design tend to be arthritic, also if this is what you have to rely on, because you don't have the control facet of the issue, this is a pretty big blow to how good you can make your software. And finally, the platform vendor trying to reuse their code, in our case, would be Apple. It's the good side is that that Apple, especially with the iPhone and their yearly release cycles, that they're moving fast and they keep on moving fast and they are evolving rapidly, and they're helping software hopefully get better. But on the downside is that we're also aligned. You know, Apple aligns their code and that they want it to use in terms of they align it to Apple's interests. So things that they are no longer interested in won't be as well supported, and things that are perhaps the deal of the day at Apple, or an important thing that they will perhaps overemphasize. Part of the thing with code reuse, when you're not just writing code for yourself, and writing for yourself, is that education and marketing, it has a big effect on what code ends up being reused. What libraries and what frameworks become popular. I mean, Java wasn't particularly good, but Sun had a huge marketing push on it, and those millions of dollars. Unfortunately, you know, our development tools seem to be pretty much controlled by corporate interests, because that's where the resources come from, and these corporations will put a lot of money into things. It would be really interesting if we could get Apple to break out how much it's spending promoting Swift in its quarterly conference calls.
I thought you meant how they were promoting it in the corporate conference calls. It's like they're probably not promoting it at all during the calls.
No. I'm just
yes. Yeah, no, I got you.
Yeah, this line.
We're all good.
Okay.
All
good. So, with the now that we covered kind of like the authorship and the control issues with the liabilities of having code. So there's this pretty great book by Robert L. Glass, and it's called Facts and Fallacies of Software Engineering. And it was written in 2003, copyright. And he has this section here on the facts of code reuse. And so I want to quickly go through them and kind of use them as talking points for other things, other aspects of it. Fact number 15, reuse in the small, that is, libraries of subroutines, began nearly 50 years ago and is a well-solved problem. So Robert here is talking about how back in the mainframe days, it was kind of like the idea of code libraries were created, and how this is, you know, the idea of having these libraries in the first place is pretty much a solved problem. And this idea of having catalogs of code that you can call and a reusable code, in the really old days, it was a pipe dream, and this has been achieved long ago. So it's not really something we have to worry about here anymore, which is pretty good. However, fact 16, reuse in the large, that is, components, remain a mostly unsolved problem, even though everyone agrees it is important and desirable. And initially, I disagreed with this with his fact here, but he goes fact 17, which I won't bother reading. Basically, says domain specific libraries have a higher reuse acceptance. So you can think of that as things like UIKit. But in general, where we've had success in reusing code has been in where a platform provider or other provider, you can think of things like Unity as a 3D gaming engine and stuff like that. That's where we've had success, is where you have some sort of vendor and you doing a domain specific library, and that has pretty much achieved reuse. When you look at the size of application development teams versus the size of the teams at Apple behind UIKit. Not just UIKit, obviously there's a lot of people in other frameworks. There's the size of people who are the size of the teams that are writing apps tends to be smaller than the number of people cranking away on the latest version of iOS. And so that kind of shows you like where the horsepower is being spent. And I think it's being spent pretty well, that the efforts of the teams at Apple are being leveraged very well against the, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of apps are in the App Store. So it seems to me like it shows that the success of where the effort is being applied. And if you let's look at then like the number of people, the ratios in terms of how, if there could be like a metric that where you can like put human life spent per line of code, if that would be a thing, then I think that this is, in terms of structure of having, say, large app teams and having a small platform team at Apple, you'd have a lot more code, I should say, less code reuse. Fact number 18, which is very interesting, because I read this book when it first came out, and I've been meaning to come back to it. This is one of the topics that's been on my list for a long time to talk about. And I was reminded of it because the Debug podcast had Nitin, what is his last name again? Oh, yeah, Ganatra. Yes.
Yeah, Nitin
Ganatra.
Ganatra, right.
Yes. I actually...
I don't know if that's actually how you pronounce it, because I don't remember when he said it anymore. But
If I mispronounce it, I blame Renee Ritchie, because I did re-download that episode and listen to the beginning of episode 2 just to hear him say the name. And okay. I even practiced it, so...
All right.
Yeah, there we go.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Let's blame him.
And one of the interesting things he said was that so he was in charge of like iOS apps when the iPhone was being created, and he was talking about like the decision of when things would get put into a framework, when the code decided that it should be reused. And he mentioned that once three separate applications had to basically roll their own component, that's when they decided, okay, this goes in a framework. And so in this the book, Fact 18, I don't know if it's wholly coincidental or if Nitin read the same book or if it just makes sense and he discovered it independently, but I'll read Fact 18 here. There are two, quote, rules of three, unquote, in reuse. First, it is three times as difficult to build reusable components as single-use components. And two, a reusable component should be tried out in three different applications before it would be sufficiently general to accept in a reusable library. So it's right. That metric matches pretty much exactly what Nitin was talking about. The idea that just having two clients of a code, it really isn't enough to say, okay, this is actually reusable. In our example, in the top of the show, where I was talking about just having just two methods that have common that need a common functionality, it's worth extracting that method. I think in the micro case. Where you're not exposing a public interface, two is sufficient. You shouldn't wait until you have a third method that needs it. But when you have something that's publicly exposed, the costs go up there. And at that point, it does probably make sense that you need to prove that you have the client demand to accept the costs. Because a lot of people talk about how code is liability. But even more than that, contracts, the interfaces you provide are a huge liability. And that's something that Apple constantly struggles with. That's why they analyze APIs so stringently. I think that's why NS Source Descriptor didn't have convenience methods for so bloody long. But it also brings up an important point about not only is it the cost of the contract for reusable code, but also to genericize code, to make it kind of generic and reusable, is also their rule of thumb here is that they estimated being three times the effort. That seems maybe high to me, but I also could see it being low. Again, with our simple example at the top of the show, where you just have one... you're just extracting code from a method into another method so you can use them from two methods. and you can already see how you might need to tweak things, maybe move some parameters and move some variables into parameters, and maybe restructure things around, and maybe offer flag to the method or something like that. So you can, oh, you can see that there's some cost involved in terms of taking this chunk of code that's working in your method, extracting it, and then being able to reuse it across two other methods. And that's only, again, in your little private microcosm, so the costs are lower there. Once you have things like table view, which is one of the examples he gave, is that they had before there was UI table view, there was this table view, and that was their internal classes, and Mail had its own, and Photos had its own, or whatever. I forget what his specific examples were, but yeah, so UI table view had to be rolled, and now you have to make the very hard decisions of what is a good API for all these. And he specifically mentioned that that they kind of burned the bridge behind themselves, that they realized that you could write a version of UI table view that says, okay, third-party developers, here is your UI table view. And while Mail.app continues us to use its own internal one because it's crazy fast because they've optimized the hell out of it, and that wouldn't fly. So they made sure that the apps had to use UI table view, and that forced the issue. So it had to be performant enough to use in the major apps. And by eating their own dog food in that way, that they subjected themselves to all the concerns the other clients of the code would have. So that's an important thing. It's easy to kind of have maybe an academic API on these things, I shouldn't even say that's easy. It's just, coming up with good design for APIs is tragically hard, but understanding kind of the performance and interface trade-offs, that requires a lot of work, a lot of thinking. And so in terms of the code itself, maybe it's, I could see it maybe double the effort, but I think perhaps even the greater time sink is the amount of effort you have to spend kind of understanding all the scenarios and thinking things through, and maybe the dreaded communication with other people. I think I'll skip these other facts because while they're about reuse, they're less having to do with the topic at hand about the complexity.
Well, maybe you can use them in another podcast.
Maybe reuse them. Very good. Very good. One of the things that I want to mention when I was talking about running your own open source project is that there's a good book on the topic, Producing Open Source Software by Carl Fogel. And it's predictably enough, it's open source itself, so you can go to its own website, producingoss.com, and I'll put a link in there. You can read it for free. And also, Brian Fitzpatrick and Ben Collins-Sussman did a great talk at Google I/O of 2008 about open source projects and poisonous people. Initially, I wanted to do kind of an entire show on managing open source projects, but I was hoping to shoehorn it all in here, but maybe it was a little bit too ambitious. But if you don't want to do the thing where you just throw your code over the wall, and you want to be a good open source citizen and kind of do the right thing. And also, another thing if your project gets popular, and you're getting deluged with maybe not so helpful suggestions, or maybe just overenthusiastic people when you don't have the time to do it and to manage it all, I think this would help. And it might be something that's better to read before that happens. Instead of after it happens, because after it happens, you're kind of under fire, and that's unfortunately it has happened to me, and that pretty much does it for me. It sounds like you have some follow up.
I have some, yeah. So let's see. So I think the episode where you mentioned the semantic versioning was the tofu scale.
Oh yes,
41.
Yes. Okay.
And we can put a link to that in the show notes. And you have a blog post called Semantic Version Branches for Submodules.
Yes.
On wrench.tumblr.com. So we'll put that in there. Let's see. And so my thinking about lots of little methods is that it makes it hard to refactor because you've already given your code sort of an infrastructure around what it actually does. So instead of just having the code itself, now you have like shells around each bit of the code. Sort of you've built houses when you've well, I know, there are probably a lot of metaphors I could use there, but you know, you want to make a skyscraper, but you've got all your construction material and houses. It's going to be harder because now you got to break down the houses to build the skyscraper. Another one was talked a little bit about open source stuff. Apple, I've heard this from more than one source that, you know, Apple's philosophy was that they put open source stuff out there when they want to keep doing it rather than to end of life it. And that's because they know that to actually have a successful open source project, you have to probably put more effort into it than you're getting out from other people's contributions, because you need to organize it, you need to deal with everything about it. So they don't want to just, they know that if you just end of life it and put it in an open source project, it'll probably just fail and be an embarrassment. So they don't want to do that.
That's a good point. I would also say that Apple obviously attracts a lot of attention. And I think that that's a dynamic there, because Apple is essentially a celebrity. But if you and I were to produce, you know, throw out the same open source project, has been far less popular, those dynamics would be different for us, even if it's the exact same code base.
Yeah, there was an article, I don't remember by whom, maybe it was a CocoaPods article, maybe it was a Matt Thompson article on NSHipster. I think it might have been Matt Thompson, where it kind of went on at length about how many what obligations you have as an open source developer, that you are required to put all of this effort into, you know, starting it up and putting semantic versioning for everything you do and closing it down the right way, that sort of a thing. And I was quite skeptical of that article, because it really did seem to be saying, you know, here's all these things I'm going to demand of you if you put any code out there at all. And if you don't do that, then it's just not acceptable. And that's, you know, I don't think that's realistic. I think that's, it's not realistic, because most people aren't going to do that. And you can get a lot of benefit out of snippets of code or small bits of code that don't need all of that, that thing. I mean, that might be what they want to do. But trying to say, well, now everybody needs to do it because that's what we like. I don't know. Kind of rubbed me a little in the wrong way.
I hear you. I'm pretty much on your side, that one.
Yeah. So let's see. You talked a little bit about backwards compatibility. I mean, the trouble with that is that the more backwards compatible stuff you support, the slower you need to go.
Right.
And that's really what happens, is that projects keep getting slower and slower because of all the stuff they need to support. Microsoft stuff seems to be a lot like this, that they've been willing to support so many old versions that it, you know, they need lots of developers to keep working on new stuff. And that's why Apple can get away with being smaller, because they deprecate so much. Let's see. I would say that when we talk about the time it takes, the teams it takes to do framework versus app development, excuse me, I would probably want more examples than just Apple versus third-party developers.
Oh, yeah?
Because Apple is pretty unique in a lot of ways. And so if we're going to generalize, I would want a couple of different cases of that, rather than just saying, well, because it works this way for Apple, and therefore it's got to work this way for everybody.
Okay, well,
Apple's pretty unique.
Would you say that also works the same way with Microsoft?
I don't know. That's probably part of our problem, right? Is that we don't know other companies as well as we do Apple. All I know is that Apple, Microsoft teams do tend to be fairly huge by Apple standards.
That's true.
That's pretty much all I know. The next thing was, you had talked about the costs of making something public, the need to come up with the cognitive costs for figuring something out and wanting to have something that would be very useful to many people. And that brought in mind NS Progress, actually, because I still don't know why they made NS Progress public. It doesn't seem like it's solving problems that third parties really need.
Yeah.
It seems like they did it for themselves. There must have been something inside of Apple that really needed this. And then somebody said, well, hey, we've done all this work to make it useful for third parties, as for you know, first parties, let's make it public. I don't know. I don't know what they were thinking. I'll be curious to find out, you know, a behind the music about NS Progress.
Yes, that is a good example. That one thing that I kind of mentioned, but indirectly, but I should call it out, is that Apple does have internal API review before an API goes out.
Yep.
And so this is something that shouldn't, that ideally, that, you know, it's almost like you what is it that I want to say, a check off that you put the gun on the table in the play and you have to use it. It's like NS Progress almost feels like that, right? They put it on the table and like you're just kind of like waiting for 10.11 or something to come out that actually...
Well, their watch, right? They're, you need progress for a watch.
Oh, okay. There
Maybe
go.
That's it. Okay, so, and then two more things. You talked about, coming up with the details of what goes into an API and what you're going to publicize. I'm also curious about the way, you said UI Table View was one you mentioned. It's also interesting to see what they made public from UI Table View that wasn't in NS Table View. Because they're not exactly the same. Of course, they're named differently, but they also act differently in some subtle ways and some big ways. And so it is kind of interesting to think about, why they did that. I think mostly they did that because it was different teams doing it, so they didn't feel the same need to make it exactly the same, and might even have had a certain pride in saying, well, our new version is more modern than the old version. But it is an interesting thing. The more you have to do cross-platform code, the more you notice these differences.
Yeah.
Then the last thing was talking about the speed of things, making things faster. It brings to mind the idea about NS Dictionary versus NS Map Table. Because an NS Dictionary is fast. It's very well optimized. And they couldn't do the same thing for NS Map Table because it's more generalized. It lets you have different kinds of keys and values rather than just objects. And so they, don't use NS Map Table unless you really need to, because if you use it as a dictionary, it won't be as fast. And that's because they had to do it that way. They couldn't put in the same shortcuts that they could with NS Dictionary. Yeah. So that's what I got.
Okay. Then that does it for me.
Alrighty, we'll see you next time.